Okej, mycket välkomna till Formel 1-podden. Formel 1-podden som är utlokaliserad till Hägersten och Aspudden idag. Vi har nämligen tagit oss hem till Scott Mitchell, tidigare journalist på Autosport, numera för The Race. Och nyligen hemkommen från Barcelona, håller på att ladda batterierna för att snart åka tillbaka till Barcelona och testvecka nummer 2. Erik Stenborg har vi släppt iväg den här veckan, så att, det får bli Scott som kommer in och tar över istället. Scott, home reloading, recharging. I know you have super much to do, but thanks for having time to be on our podcast.
Well, you've made it easier by coming down here. So it's a lot nicer. No, it's good to get a couple of days off. I must admit, it's slightly nicer coming home here in between the two tests than when I lived in West London, which is a bit greyer, a bit more miserable, a bit more rainy, and here. It's quite lovely outside.
Yeah,
isn't it? It's
like today
bright,
it is.
Bright blue skies. It's not warm. It's never warm at this time of the year here. But no, it's really nice. It's a good, really good way to sort of recharge, because first test is hectic and then second test is when it gets interesting. So you've got to be all guns blazing.
That's the case, yes. You never had any thoughts about staying in Barcelona for a few days?
No, my colleague Ed Straw is out there in between. Ed quite likes minimising his travel between, and it works quite nicely, I think. For back-to-back races, I think it's quite useful to just sort of stay out and then either spend an extra day in one country and then go over to the next. But for testing, just because it was so intense, and obviously the test is slightly shorter this year, you have that extra day. I just thought, come back a couple of days to properly recharge. I prefer Sweden to Spain, so I'm perfectly happy to come back here.
I exactly know what you mean. Every extra night you can have in your own bed is worth so much. Okay, let's skip that part and get right on to it, to the Formula One testing. We have seen 3 days of testing, quite interesting, I think. I was watching the whole thing from home, and it's televised both weeks for the first time. Last year we had the first week televised, this year both weeks, which is convenient, I think, for the teams as well, because they get a chance to really see the competitors on track.
And they also get a little bit more data as well, because basically what they've done this year is turned it into a big proper F1 event. So that means there's more stuff like the timing loops and the data that they're producing Formula One in terms of the timing and everything else. The teams have that, so it's a little bit of payback, because they have to put what they're doing more on display, but in return they get a little bit more of an idea of what everybody's doing. So that's quite interesting. And obviously the big thing, because the main talking point from testing was obviously day two, Lewis Hamilton pulls his steering wheel back towards him on the straight and everyone's eyes pop out of their head. We wouldn't have had that without the testing. Imagine if we didn't have that live coverage. We might not have found out about the DAS until FP1 in Melbourne, and now it's the biggest talking point in the F1 paddock. So I think it's worked quite well.
So speaking about DAS or dual axis steering, how important is it? Is it a deal breaker?
I think that's the question that now all of Mercedes' rivals are going to try and work out the answer to really quickly, because the second morning of the test was the first time that Mercedes had run it on track, and now it's about refining the system, working out how much of a benefit it brings. Obviously, a team like Mercedes, you don't develop that and put it on the car unless you think there is a genuine potential advantage to gain from it. I think it's the sort of thing that there will be a very small gain over one lap, because when you bring the front wheels in and they just track a little bit straighter, there is a small straight line speed boost to gain from that, because the tyres scrub less, it's better for the aero. So there will be a small gain there. It'll be quicker off the corners as well. But the main thing will be over a race distance, and especially on tracks where you're really hard on the outside front tyre, for example, because Pirelli reckon that just by straightening up the front wheels, even by that, you might cool it by an extra 5 degrees, and it'll take a little bit less pressure off the shoulder of the tyre, and that is the area that tends to overheat and blister and cause all sorts of nasty problems. So that's where it will pay back, and it might only be a second in lap time, but it could be an extra lap on a stint or an extra 2 laps on a stint. We don't know. And if that's the case, and it's as close as we are really hoping it's going to be this year with Mercedes versus Ferrari versus Red Bull, that might be the difference. It could well be the game changer. Unsurprisingly, Mercedes' rivals are all trying to play it down. Oh no, we'll see, and let's see how good it actually is. But I think it's the sort of thing that this is why Mercedes are so good and 6-time double champions.
And as I understand it, this has always been the compromise: how much toe out and camber you can have without destroying the tires too early and create too much drag on the straights. So this is a really, really clever way of getting around a very old problem.
Yeah, it's a brilliant solution, because you're right, when you have that setup, that's about maximizing it on the corners. And the alternative would be you can have the front wheels tracking absolutely straight and true, slightly better on the straights, but you wouldn't have that performance in the corners. And F1's rules are quite specific. You can't have anything that adjusts the suspension while the car's moving. So all of those tricky suspension components, they are locked in. And then when we get to a race weekend, you've got parc fermé conditions. So once you set the car for qualifying, you can't then change it for the race. So an F1 car is always designed with compromises in mind. And this is just that's why this is so clever, because it's a system that for 2020 only, really, Mercedes will be able to balance, and they will basically be able to set that car up a bit more optimally for the straights without taking away the cornering performance. It's just genius. I'm really, really impressed by it.
And already it's banned for 21. We know that. Somehow they know that they don't want this kind of devices on the car. So it's going to only be this year that you're going to be able to use it. But is it right to have a thing like this that can correct the car while running?
I don't know. I think, to me, this is what it makes F1 brilliant, because there are lots of little innovations in Formula 1, but you don't really see them because they're often under the surface, and it's difficult to really get a grasp of just how much effort goes into the design of these cars and to make them a little bit more perfect. Basically, it's all about these marginal gains. So I think it's absolutely spot on, because there are rigorous safety tests and everything that they need to go through. So this system will have had to have gone through the FIA crash tests, and it would have passed it. So it's not unsafe. The drivers, it's not an automatic system, so the drivers have to do it themselves, which means it can't happen by accident. They won't be halfway through a corner, a really quick corner, and suddenly the steering wheel moves and they lose control. You're more likely to crash because the driver's got a bit too quick on the throttle than you are because of a problem here. So the only reason, in my mind, this is wrong is if it's unsafe. But there are there's so much criteria to satisfy now. It can't be safe. The only way the DAS fails and causes a problem is if something fails within the steering system. But that goes for a normal steering rack as well.
So this is considered to be part of the steering, not the suspension. That is why it's legal now. Is that the case, sir?
I think so, yeah. And I think that's why, even though Mercedes rivals have sort of indicated that there might be a parc fermé problem, because going back to this rule where everything's set once you start qualifying, you can't change it in the race, the argument would be that if it alters anything within the suspension setup, then that would make it in the race different to what they've declared before qualifying. But again, as I mentioned just now, there are already strict rules that say you can't change the suspension settings on the car while it's in motion. So Mercedes has obviously already gone to the FIA with this design, and the FIA's technical department have given them the provisional green light in principle. And they wouldn't have done that if this contravened that suspension regulation, which must mean that the FIA's technical department considers it a steering mechanism, not a suspension mechanism. And then, so to go one step further, if you apply the parc fermé logic, it's not changing any suspension element because it's not considered part of the suspension. And the key argument will be from Mercedes rivals, they will basically try, and if they decide to protest it, they're still within their rights to, and it's not 100% guaranteed that the Grand Prix weekend stewards would agree with what the FIA technical department has told Mercedes, but it would be really unlikely for them to go against it. The only real reason I can think why they would is if, however Mercedes presented the system to the FIA, is different to how they use it in practice. So I think it should be okay, which is why Mercedes are quite smug about it.
And we sort of take for granted now that you who are listening know what DAS is, the dual axis steering. It's a way for Mercedes to change the toe angle on the front wheels to straighten the tires up on the straights and go back to toe out when you come into the corner. That is what we're talking about, the DAS system. Let's leave that because it is what it is. We don't really know how it works. It could be different solutions for it, and Mercedes obviously don't tell us much about it and what it does. But it's there, and they're probably going to use it. Talking about Mercedes instead, in terms of pace, they were really quick as well. Just a few tenths of the lap record, which was set by Valtteri Bottas in qualifying last year. Yeah, of course it was on a C5 tire, but still it was at least 30-35 kilos of fuel in the car. So it's a quick time.
Yeah, and very impressive because this crop of car, I think in 2020 we're going to have many more lap records fall after last year. I think two-thirds of the lap records were broken last year. And we're going to have more go this year. And then I think this year's records are going to stand for a long time because when the rules change in 21... the cars are going to get quite a bit slower, anywhere between 3 and 6 seconds, depending on who you ask. So I think we should savour how quick these cars are going to be, because I think this could be the quickest F1 goes for quite a long time. I would be amazed if we don't have a new track lap record this week for the second test. I think Mercedes, Ferrari and Red Bull all have the capability to go below it, and I'd be really interested to see if any of the leading midfield teams do as well, because all signs point to these cars being about a second quicker than last year, which is ultra impressive. And that gives you a good idea of what to look out for when, if teams go below that or get anywhere near the lap record and then go below it, then you know that they're probably doing a qualifying run.
Yeah. And Mercedes was really quick. Valtteri Bottas making the quickest lap of all. Was 7/10 quicker than Lewis Hamilton. But I guess Lewis never chased the ultimate lap time on his tries on the softer tyre. He did a run on C4 and C5.
I think he did one, but I think he got it slightly wrong. I think he was pushing quite hard and the lap just sort of got away from him. That again, a bit of an indicator that it was almost a qualifying simulation because he was on the limit and he went a little bit over it.
It's interesting to see, though, that Mercedes is really pushing for performance already in the first week. We saw quite the opposite way of taking on the testing last year. This year is more Ferrari who is keen on knowing what the car can do and keen on getting the setup window wider than they had last year.
Yeah, they've sort of swapped around because last year, if you remember, when Mercedes changed the car quite dramatically between test one and test two, because a year ago when we had that change in the front wing regulation, so Mercedes locked in quite early to a really basic sort of point to start with on their car, go there for the first week of testing, then bring upgrades and try and unlock a bit more performance in week two. Whereas this year, because the regulations have stayed the same, they know where they needed to evolve the car. They have evolved it in a few areas, but you go to testing and it's more of a known quantity. So they're able to go there and just sort of get down to work a little bit quicker, which is why they've been able to add a bit more performance to the car earlier, because they can just work through that program quicker. But Ferrari, with their 2019 to 2020 changes, they've basically gone for more downforce. There's a lot more that's different, really, about this Ferrari compared to last year than there is between the two Mercedes. So Ferrari need to do that work to try and understand it. They want to make that, as you said, the setup window wider. So now they're trying to play with setups, go from one extreme to the other and see what changes and how the car reacts.
And the comments from the drivers, is it how do you interpret the way they look, both Sebastian and Charles, when they get out of the car, and you listen to Mattia Binotto saying that they are clearly behind both Red Bull and Mercedes at this point anyway?
I think there is an element of gamesmanship. I think Ferrari really learned their lesson from last year because they got quite a big slap in the face when they went to Australia. They left testing thinking they were ahead or at the very least in with a very good chance of winning in Australia. And obviously they didn't even get on the podium in Melbourne. And that stung. And by the end of the year, Mattia Binotto had admitted, yeah, we got that wrong. We're going to change it for 2020. So they've been a lot more, I think they've been playing down their chances a lot more.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
But that said, I do believe Binotto when he says that the lap time's not coming quite as easily as they want. I wonder if that is partly because they haven't tried to find that perfect setup yet. They've been working through different things. So maybe, as well as taking the fuel out of the car and turning the engine modes up, I wonder if they will just sort of lock in a little bit more to what where the sweet spot is with this car, and that's where the lap time will come from. But as it stands, I've said this a couple of times now in the last few days, Ferrari have had a slightly troubled start to testing. They had an engine problem on the final day. All three of the big teams and their engine manufacturers had a setback of some kind. And they don't have that headline lap time. And it's all well and good saying that they're hiding a second in engine power and things like this, but they do then need to actually go out and do it. So this week is really interesting because we can see the Mercedes quick, we think that the Red Bull is very quick, and we suspect that the Ferrari can go a lot quicker than it's going now. So
it's interesting that because we know, you and I know, that when the team optimizes, because they have so much simulation done before they come to Barcelona, they know exactly how to put the car, how to set it up and to be quick, and for in the case of Ferrari now, they don't. They try to this sort of provoke the car to do different things. Is there a risk of getting confused as a driver?
I think in the past probably more of a risk, because you can end up sort of making too many changes. And actually Max Verstappen talked about this from Red Bull's point of view. He says that sometimes there's a lot of value in just going out and leaving the car the same. Otherwise you spend all your time changing the setup, but you get so much more track time at a test than you do in a Grand Prix weekend. And that track is changing all the way from the morning until the flag drops. So how can you actually be certain that the change that you've made on the car is what's made the difference? What if it's because track temperature's up a few degrees, or because it's rubbered in a little bit more? So I don't think Ferrari know exactly where that sweet spot is on their car yet. That's why the next 3 days are important. And this goes back to what we were saying about Mercedes a year ago. They brought their new parts for the second test and they thought, here we go, this is going to fix it. And then the first two or three days, they didn't have anything. They were like, well, hang on a second, why are we not loads quicker? And it was only on the last day of the test that Mercedes properly unlocked the potential in their 2019 car. And I wonder if that's the process Ferrari is having to go through now. So it isn't just that they are clearly sandbagging. Ferrari aren't going to go to Melbourne and be the eighth fastest team or whatever.
No way.
I'd be amazed if that would be a horrific failure if they did. But there is definitely work to do.
So in your gut, what is your gut feeling? How far behind? Are we talking 1-2 tenths, maybe, if they are behind at all?
Yeah, I think we're definitely only talking a matter of tenths. I have to put Mercedes on top at the moment because that car, it just looks good. It's reliable. We've heard a lot from James Allison, the technical director there, about how big an improvement they've made on the engine side and also the aero side. And from the Red Bull camp, I can just see a certain confidence and swagger about the way, you know, the way Max is just totally chilled. Christian Horner looks quite happy. So, and that car looks really good on track. But I don't know if they're quite at Mercedes level. But I think those two are there or thereabouts. And then I think Ferrari, at the moment, I reckon if everyone took all of the fuel out of their car and cranked the engines up to 10, I think Ferrari might be a tenth or two behind. But I think there is that pace in the car if they unlock it. So I think it is actually very hard to split them, and we shouldn't read too much into the negative comments that people are making in the press. They will get some answers this week, because when the fuel goes in and they do all of their race runs, it's much harder to lie about the performance of your car.
I know that Mark Hughes, who is working together with you guys, have sort of crunched the numbers and have seen the pictures more clear, and see that Ferrari is not way off anyway. They are about the same level as Mercedes.
Yeah, it's interesting because you can always look at the little stints that everybody does, and then obviously extrapolating that data is a bit risky, because what you see over 16 laps isn't necessarily what you see in reality over 66. But taking your best guesses and estimates of what fuel load people might be running, and assuming that you can work out from the GPS, because the teams have the GPS data and we don't. So what Mercedes has indicated is that Ferrari is running a very detuned version of its engine at the moment, and you can make that comparison compared to their customer team. So they can see on the data that the time for an Alfa Romeo or a Haas between point A and point B is a lot quicker than the Ferrari. So the estimate is that they're about a second down on engine power. So let's see, because that's a big jump on its own. You take the fuel out, that's a big jump on its own, and you actually start to really try and chase performance of the car setup. So yeah, it'll be close. I'm pretty sure it'll be close.
So we have talked a lot about Mercedes and a lot about Ferrari. Red Bull, you mentioned, looks very good on track. Max Verstappen seemed relaxed about the situation. Christian Horner seems okay with everything, and a lot of laps for once from Red Bull side. It's the reliability is there.
Even though they had a bit of a reliability problem on day two, when Honda, they didn't see anything at the track, but Honda were running their dyno work back at Sakura in Japan alongside it, and they spotted something on the data that worried them a little bit. So the advice from Japan was to change the engine track side. And normally, an engine change on day two of testing, that's like McLaren Honda territory of, oh, that's a bit of a scare, especially because day one was so good. Almost three times a Grand Prix distance that Max Verstappen did on day one. But this is how good that Red Bull Honda partnership has got, and how much better Honda's got, even with an engine change and a reliability setback. I think Alex Albon still did 130 laps on day two. That's a massive amount of laps. And Red Bull have had basically their best first week of testing ever. They're pretty confident that what they've done on the car has fixed a few of the stability problems of last year. And Honda seems to have delivered again on the power and reliability side. So I really want to see that car do a proper quali sim this week, or at least close to one, because everything sort of seems like it should add up to a really quick time. And on Mercedes level, until you actually see it, you don't know for certain.
No, and I guess we have to wait until maybe, now we don't go to, but let's say Bahrain, the qualifying in Bahrain, which is the first proper track, although it's kind of different circumstances coming there anyway, but Australia and Albert Park is so different to any other track, so it's hard to judge by coming there as well. And the thing that I wonder most is, has Honda found the 20-30 extra horsepower just for the quali laps, for the Q3 laps?
Yeah,
because the race engine is good enough already. Mm.
In race trim, I think they're pretty much there with Mercedes. They certainly were at the end of last year. For outright performance, it's difficult to know, because I think it's characteristics of the engine and the way the engine's designed. But we saw at high altitude last year, Mexico, and then again in Brazil, the Honda, that is actually bang on in certain conditions in qualifying. But I don't know whether it's going to be because of just the way that engine's designed. They seem to be trying to play down the impact of altitude and just sort of saying, oh, it's just the way the package works together and stuff like that.
I guess the cooling is quite efficient on the engine, or the engine is not as sensitive to cooling as, for instance, Mercedes.
Well, we saw that in Austria as well, didn't we? It was really hot there.
That's what I mean.
That was quite telling, I think, of how much progress Honda had made, because normally, in the past, they've been the really fragile ones on reliability. But that was a weekend where engine reliability and cooling and all the factors involved in that decided that Grand Prix. And it was Mercedes that had the big problem, and Ferrari were a bit off it as well. It was Honda that did the business. So let's see what they've done for this year. That again, it's a bit like the Red Bull on the car side. All the noise coming from the camp is quite positive. They've not gone anywhere near the high power modes. We've seen a little bit, I think, from, I was going to say Toro Rosso, AlphaTauri, obviously, that they've turned it up a little bit more, and that looks promising. But yeah, even this week when they bolt C5 tyres on and seem to like absolutely go for it, it's still going to be really difficult to actually know what that car's capable of.
Okay, but to me it looks like we have a good fight on our hands, top three wise, with the three biggest teams. Then we end up with the midfield, or do we have a field within the top three and the midfield? I think about McLaren and Renault. Are they going to be a little bit quicker than the rest of the midfield and sort of building their own championship in between?
I think those two and maybe Racing Point with the pink Mercedes from last year, I think those three are the ones that have that potential to start to bridge the gap. Renault seemed to be a bit more encouraged by the end of the week than they were at the start. They had a little bit of a weird one. It wasn't a massively impressive day one. Even though you've got that visibly different front of the car with the nose. Day two, they lost track time because Ricciardo smashed a curb and then they lost some time there. But then day three really salvaged it, loads of mileage and quite a quick lap time as well. McLaren were really talking up how good their week was, even though there was no lap time. And they have what Carlos Sainz called a very basic car, because they're basically going to bring all of their performance bolt-on bits for week two. So I think those two teams, because you had Renault were fourth best a couple of years ago, McLaren were fourth best last year, those are the two that if anyone's going to make a bit of a jump towards the top three, it'll be those two, based on the momentum and the resources available. But then you've got Racing Point in the mix as well, because we know how good the 2019 Mercedes was. And that doesn't mean that Racing Point, by trying to copy them and replicate that design, means that they're going to win races or score podiums this year. Because, as we said, this crop of cars should, in theory, be a second quicker than last year's or something like that. So, but that would be enough to put them right at the front of that midfield fight. And we know how good the technical team is there, because when that team was Force India and they didn't have a lot of money, they regularly built the fourth or fifth fastest car. So those are the three that I'm looking at and thinking that could be quite interesting. I think it's going to come down to the developments they put on the car in week two, and then how much they're able to improve the car by the time we get to Australia.
Speaking about Racing Point, it's quite interesting to see that now that they have the funding, they pursue the way of building a car like Mercedes have built their car. They pursue their philosophy of building a race car, which they, I guess, haven't had enough money to do previous years. They have the gearbox, they have the engine, they have the suspension from Mercedes, at least in the back of the car. But then they had their own concept with a lot more rake than Mercedes uses. Now, as you say, it's a clone.
And it makes sense to do that, because the way they've explained it, and it goes for AlphaTauri and Red Bull, if you have physical architecture within your car, especially in this F1 context where you've got the gearbox at the back and then the way the rear suspension is, the geometry is around the pickup points at the back of the car, that defines quite significantly how that rear end is packaged. And Mercedes isn't going to build a gearbox that doesn't fit the philosophy that it is trying to do with its entire car, which means their lower rake philosophy is a clash with what you need from the back of the car for a higher rake concept, which is what Racing Point kept trying to do. But they did that because they persevered with higher rake for a long time, and because they didn't have any money, they kept having to carry over the chassis and carry over the concept year on year. And so you end up in a position where you're basically, it's like trying to push water upstream, because you can't change it because you don't have the money to, but you're still trying to pursue a concept that parts of your car aren't best suited to. So quite a difficult situation. But now they've finally got the money, they've gone, well, let's throw away the design work we were doing before, and let's look at what Mercedes have done, because they've not been given any secret information from Mercedes. It is basically look at photos of them and say, okay, this looks like this, this seems to do this. Can we make our own version of that? Put it in the wind tunnel, put it on the CFD.
In the Mercedes wind tunnel as well.
Yeah, exactly. And then actually see if they can get it to all come together. But as anyone who, you know, it's like anything, you, I can have a look at my kitchen table and say, okay, well, it looks like this, the legs shaped down like this, I've got a picture of it, I'm going to make one that's exactly the same as that. It isn't that simple, because you then need to actually get the design right, you need to manufacture it properly, you need to get everything to work together. An F1 car is so complicated, and it's how everything connects that makes it successful. And if it was that easy to do what Mercedes have done, then they'd have been beaten by somebody by now.
For sure, it's like that. But it was impressive to see the Racing Point, the Racing Point car the first 2 days, and they had the pace immediately. And then you don't seem to... I didn't think that it was glory runs, all of it anyway. Maybe a few low fuel runs with a lot of engine power to see where they are, because they have a lot more to collect. But on the other hand, they cannot do like Ferrari and be very thorough. They need to sort of start somewhere.
I think that when you've done a big change like that, and Racing Point have talked it up as being a big risk in terms of switching that concept, throwing out everything you've learned to try something new.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You've got to get down to business quite quickly, because how else are you going to work out what you're doing wrong? How else are you going to know, oh, I think we're getting the most out of this? So I suspect they'll have been pushing quite hard. And I think the same, that's why I think like where they ended up relative to Renault, and then the fact that they were a few tenths quicker than like Alfa Romeo and Alfa Tauri, I think that is relatively a good, accurate depiction of how that midfield looks. I just don't know exactly where McLaren's going to fit into that, because they were the fourth best team last year. If they've made the same step that everyone else has made, then they're going to be further ahead again. But Racing Point have made a big change. Renault have made a big change. So in theory, that's going to be a really interesting battle. And it's quite cool, because you've got a proper works team in Renault. You've got that sort of independent in McLaren that's also using a Renault engine. But we know what McLaren is. They're historically such a successful team, and we know the resources they've got there. And then you've got Racing Point, which is a smaller, leaner operation, trying to do something that neither of those teams are doing by using technology from a big manufacturer like Mercedes. So it's quite interesting. You've got three different concepts of F1 teams there going about building their cars and designing their cars in a different way.
Talking about McLaren, they say from their own side that there is a big change in the concept of the car this year, with James Key behind the car for the first time in the proper way anyway. Have you seen any signs of that new concept so far? I haven't.
When they launched the car, I thought, okay, well, you can see that they've gone towards that pit lane trend now of the narrower nose, which is something, and the side pods look quite good as well. So as the further back you go on the car, you can see it slightly aggressively more packaged. I think there are quite clear signs that this is a proper James Key car. It's not just a carryover of what the technical team from before were doing, but they don't have that same level of intricacy on the barge board area. And this is where I think when Carlos Sainz says it's a basic car and they'll have upgrades, I wonder if this will be where we see it. Are they gonna have a bit more of a sophisticated barge board area, or are we going to see something interesting turn up in that sort of cape area under the nose, or what are they going to do that suddenly makes you go, oh, I can see why that last car was basic, because it looks like quite a good car. So I'm interested to see how much more complicated it can get.
Okay, then we have Alfa Tauri and we have Alfa Romeo, as we said. I leave Williams for last because I assume they are last still, but a lot better than last year. But let's stick with Alfa Romeo and Alfa Tauri. Seem to be quite evenly matched at the moment as well. Kimi is Kimi, saying to everyone that the testing is you only make up stories, blah blah blah. But testing is testing, and it's testing for him as well. What do you reckon you have seen from Alfa Tauri and Alfa Romeo so far?
I think it will be a little bit similar to last year because I don't really see anything from those two that indicate they'll jump forward and lead the midfield. I think if I had to put money on either of them bringing a surprise, it would be Alfa Tauri because it's that combination of they use components from last year's Red Bull where they can. But by doing that, it's not just about making sure that, you know, those bits on the car are mega. By not having to worry about those, the technical team there can then focus on the areas that they need to focus on, like the aero part. So in theory, there you've got that. It's a bit similar to what Haas do with Ferrari, and a little bit similar as well to what Racing Point are doing with Mercedes, although Racing Point don't go quite as far. The whole point is that you leave the big bits of construction and design to a bigger constructor, and then you focus your manufacturing and development work on the other key performance differentiators, and then it's about who does the best job within that area. So I think AlphaTauri have got a bit of an advantage there, but I think the problem for you and your fellow commentators is that I think they are probably going to be quite close to each other.
Alpha is following an alpha. Yeah,
exactly. The only good thing is at least they've painted the cars different colours for you. Well, you know, it's the blue alpha or the red alpha.
That's correct. Someone must have thought about this when they decided to rename Toro Rosso Alfa Tauri, where Alfa Romeo has been there now for a few seasons. So it's funny how I see the point in making it Alfa Tauri because the branding of the Red Bull clothing series or whatever it is. So I guess they want to try to sell more clothes.
It's just annoying because for Alfa Romeo, it's always been Alfa. Like, that is how you say it. Like, that's the short version of the name. Yeah. Alfa Tauri, there isn't. It's presented as one word, so are you gonna just say Alfa Tauri every time?
Yeah, probably have to, because I said Toro Rosso the last year. Yeah. The last year when they were Toro Rosso, so I guess Alfa Tauri, I will call them Alfa Tauri, but I'm gonna slip over and say Toro Rosso every now and then as well, which I did with Alfa Romeo and call them Sauber once in a while as well. So
if you say Alfa, listeners should know that Alfa means Alfa Romeo.
Yeah.
It's not a short version of Alfa Tauri.
Not now anyway. Let's see whatever happens. But for me, Alfa is Alfa Romeo, and Alfa Tauri will be Alfa Tauri. So I guess that's the way to sort of separate them.
People ask me sort of why we should refer to it as Alfa Tauri and not Toro Rosso, but it has changed identity completely, and also there was no reason to call the other team Toro Rosso. It was just that's what Red Bull decided to name it, so it's not like in the Minardi days when it was the eponymous team owner. Dietrich Mateschitz isn't called Dietrich Toro Rosso, is he?
No.
So there's no real issue here. I get that it's a little bit weird because it's also a clothing company or brand, whatever you want to call it, that people haven't heard of. But that's why you do this sort of thing, isn't it? Because
exactly. I mean, that's the only point. I mean, the only reason they do it is to make us aware of this clothing brand or whatever it is. Ending up with Williams then. Williams who have a, I mean, to me the car looks okay. I understand that it lacks overall downforce, so that it can't go as quick as the big teams or even the best teams in the midfield. But it's a lot better, more reliable car for the driver as well.
Yeah, and everything surrounding that team and the new car was quite positive last week. They're not going to suddenly jump into Q3 contention and score points every week or anything like that. But I think they've got half a chance now of actually fighting for a Q2 place, which is what they need to do, is close that gap and be part of the midfield again. The most interesting comment I heard was actually from my colleague Gary Anderson, obviously a race-winning F1 technical director, who went trackside and said the Williams actually looks like a racing car this year, whereas 12 months ago in testing it was terrible. It was a pig.
Yeah.
George Russell said the first few times he drove the car last year were actually quite scary, and he used that word, whereas this car instills more confidence. I think it's a bit more of a well-rounded package. If I'm being completely honest, and it's not to be harsh or nasty, I think this is the sort of car they needed to start last year with, and that would have been the right step. So I think they are still a year at least behind where everyone else is, but as long as they've done a really good job within that, there is no reason why that can't be a contender for the 8th or 9th spot among the teams. And it's got to be better than last year anyway, when George and Robert Kubica were just fighting almost exclusively for 19th and 20th, and it was just sad. It's painful to see that team. It's a little bit like it's a bit too much like the Caterham and Manor and Marussia, yeah, HRT days, yeah, where you saw a car. Yeah,
we had the same problem with Sauber a couple of years as,
yeah,
well.
Exactly.
They were so off the pace, running the old Ferrari engine or whatever it is. It's no good. I mean, it's sad, as you say. It's no fun. But well, it seems like they have the organization in place this year. No hiccups infrastructurally and stuff like that, so they can build on this car.
Well, last year was really bad. The car was late to testing, started 2.5 days after everybody else. It was slow, and also parts of the design that were illegal as well. So they had to be changed. Whereas this time, George Russell was the first driver out of the pit lane on the first day, and okay, you know, that doesn't mean anything.
That was
in
a statement.
Yeah, exactly. And it just shows how far the team's come. Yeah. And even from Abu Dhabi last year, because obviously that car did get better, even though it was the worst car on the grid, it did improve.
Yeah.
And they're still adamant that it is a lot stronger than it was when they ended the season. So encouraging signs. Like I say, they're not going to go out and start performing miracles or anything like that, but they'll be in the fight, and that's what F1 needs. You need 10 competitive teams, not 9 and something that's become a little bit of a sad laughing stock at the back, which ultimately is what Williams started to turn into.
Is the whole field much more even this year than, for instance, last year? Is it tighter? It seems tighter time-wise this year.
Yeah, even if you, obviously, because Williams was a bit of an anomaly last year, so if you take it from Mercedes at the top last year to Haas as the 9th team, because Williams was so far off, I do believe that is closer. I think the 10 teams are now more tightly spread than the top 9 teams were last year. I think we'll go to Australia, and as you said earlier, because Australia is a bit of a weird one, I think it could be an absolute lottery who gets through into Q2. And I know that's not the most exciting part of the weekend, but I always quite like seeing who's going to fall, who are going to be the first people to be eliminated. So
me too.
I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, sometimes that's the most unpredictable part of qualifying, is who's getting it wrong and who's getting it right to sort of go through to the second round, because that's a game changer for them. In the back, in the front, it's usually the same, you know. Okay, another thing which I think was interesting from the testing part when I watched it on TV was when they took a lap from Julian Palmer in 2017 in the Renault and compared it to a lap with the 2020 car. It's only 3 years. I mean, the difference was massive, massive. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, the struggle Palmer had with the 2017 car compared to how they drive now with the 2020 car. And I had the same sensation last year when I saw the cars. I think it was Charles Leclerc in the Ferrari. He was doing a lap, and he was basically cruising, super quick, but cruising. Just one turn in, a constant radius, and everything was so cool, so calm. And you start realizing how much grip these cars have. And I saw an interesting comment from Esteban Ocon that he thought that this was the car with most grip he has ever driven,
which is really, really impressive. And especially, as you said, that progression from 2017 to now, when you think that last year we did have those front wing changes that took some of that downforce off the car. So there has actually been something that has even knocked them back, and they're still getting quicker. Like, you just can't stop. These teams are ridiculous. Mm. They're just relentless in making these cars faster. So it goes back to what I was saying before. I think these are going to be comfortably the fastest cars we've ever had. And as long as the trade is that we get better racing, it's not that much of a problem if they get slower, especially because we know that what these cars do in qualifying is so different to what we see in the races anyway. They're 6-7 seconds slower in the race anyway. So
I mean, from the quickest, I saw a race round from Daniel Ricciardo on Friday when he did like 123s, 124s the first 20 laps. And you know that Valtteri Bottas had done 115.7 with fairly amount of fuel on board his car. So, I mean, it's two different categories, basically.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. But just to pick up on the point that you made about the onboards, and it can look effortless. I watched Bottas's fastest lap from the first test, and you just think that these cars, they've got so much grip and performance now. I found it interesting because last year, I think Kevin Magnussen talked about this, because obviously Haas had a really bad 2019. And he says that these cars are so good now and everything feels so glued to the surface, the track surface, it's actually quite difficult to spot a problem because the car feels good. There's so much downforce, it doesn't feel like you can get more grip. But then you see the lap time and you just think, well, why are we so slow? And when I was watching Bottas, I remember just thinking, how can this be quicker? I can't visibly see any mistakes. He's hitting every apex. The how late he's braking and turning for some of the corners is frightening. How does this get quicker? But it will get quicker. By the time we get to go back to Spain for week two of testing, it will be quicker. And when we're back there for the Grand Prix, it might be even quicker still. I think we'll probably be in the 1 minute 14s, which is an outrageously
terrifying
fast
pace. Yeah, it's strange. I totally agree with that. That's why we need the regulation change now for 21. We need to sort of take away some of the pace because they're going to gain it back. Maybe not the whole thing, but at least 3 or 4 seconds in two seasons.
And when you see the performance that these cars have, you realise why the racing is not good now.
Yeah.
Because there are no braking zones or turning phases. It's all just... the more and more corners are just becoming straights. So where do you expect overtaking to happen? Because the cars can't follow, they fall a bit back, and there aren't braking zones or anything to make up that time again or launch an overtake. So I don't care if the cars get 3 or 4 seconds quicker, it's sad in a way because, as I said, F1 is this pursuit of excellence. So in theory, they should always get quicker, but if the trade-off is better racing, it is a sport and an entertainment business as much as it is a technical competition. So I'd happily make that trade, but it has to work. They can't be slower and be bad at racing.
No, that's the key thing, because that was the case back in 2014 when we had bad reliability as well, and the best car in GP2, whatever it was called then, was like starting P17 in the Formula One race, which is not okay. Should be a bigger difference. So I understand what they did back in 15 when they said that that we need to go a lot quicker than the Q2 time or Q1 time in 2015 for the 17 cars, and then we have just gone quicker and quicker and quicker, and as you say. But still, if you think about that, we still had a lot of good racing last year. Even if the cars are really quick, I'm a bit worried about this year if it is like it looks like. But I had the exact same feeling at the test last year, that what can these guys do better? It's impossible. They just go around and they turn in and they as you say, they hit the apex, they brake when they should brake, and they just, how can they go quicker? It's not possible.
This is why it's so important that Red Bull and Ferrari are at the races this year, because the big thing that we lacked last year was there just was no title narrative. I think it was probably the best F1 season for quite a few years, because pretty much after France, I don't think there was ever a race weekend where I was like, oh, this, they're going to win, aren't they? But you didn't know, because we went to Austria, and obviously Red Bull won there, and then we went to Germany and Ferrari should have won there, but then Max won, went to Britain in between and Silverstone, and you know, Mercedes were back on top, and after the summer break it was anybody's guess, especially when Ferrari had the quite controversial power boost, and suddenly they were dominating qualifying, but they weren't turning that into race wins. So if we have that from the beginning, okay, if it means that over the 20, well, hopefully we'll have 22 races, but let's say you have an even split and each team dominates one third of the races. As long as that's done in a way that at least makes it interesting on that given weekend and then contributes to a championship, like, that's fine, because that will be better than what we've had before. But I am a bit, I'm not entirely convinced how easily we'll have wheel-to-wheel fights. Maybe what we saw between Leclerc and Verstappen at Silverstone and Austria last year might be a bit trickier to do this time around. But we can always hope, because I suspect, as you said, people probably thought the same a year ago.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, and I certainly hope that we can get some proper racing this year as well, even though the cars are really, really quick. Okay, looking at certain drivers then, what tickles you? I'm interested in the intra fight between Daniel Ricciardo and Esteban Ocon, of course. Ocon comes back, and Ricciardo evidently doesn't think very much of Esteban Ocon, even though he doesn't say it in public. But I know I know for a fact that he doesn't like Ocon very much, and it's going to be a very, very aggressive Ocon who needs to take control of the team. Otherwise, he's going to be number two easy peasy.
Was it Hungary? Was it Hungary in 2017 or something like that, when Ocon, I think he blocked Ricciardo. It was either blue flags in the race or qualifying or something, and Ricciardo said over the radio, "Who was that?" And he got told it was Ocon, and he was just like, "I don't like that guy's face." Like he really. I think there is needle there, but what's interesting is, as well as Ocon needing to prove himself, Ricciardo might be on his way out of the team. If Ricciardo gets halfway through the year and decides, or even earlier, and decides, "I'm not staying here," or he gets an offer from Ferrari to replace Sebastian Vettel, why would he care about his relationship with Ocon and in the team?
So I don't think he does it anyway.
But I think if he thinks, because they're not idiots, and I think if they can be managed to a degree, if they can at least be respectful towards each other, I think if you're Renault, a Ricciardo Ocon partnership is really, really good, especially if you do nail it in 21 and you've got a potential car that can fight for podiums. I think you've got a really strong lineup there. So ideally, Cyril Abiteboul and Alain Prost, they're going to want to keep Ricciardo and Ocon together. And if that's the case, I think Ricciardo and Ocon, I think they tread the line a little bit more carefully. If Ricciardo's on his way out, I don't see any reason for him to go, "Well, I'm going to give this guy some respect because I don't like him and I want to prove that I'm the big dog," and leaving on a high. So I can see that turning into sparks. I think it'll be, we know how much Grosjean and Magnussen, for example, at Haas have clashed. And if anyone watches the Netflix Drive to Survive series, the I think it's the second episode of the second season.
You've seen it?
I've not seen it, but I know what's in it. And some of the stuff about the Magnussen-Grosjean relationship is stunning. And Günther Steiner is in like peak sweary Steiner form. So that's really worth watching. And I wonder if Ocon Ricciardo will go down that route. At best case scenario, I think it will still be as bad as Leclerc and Vettel, where they don't necessarily hate each other, but they can't help but have a little bit of needle on track. And then worst case scenario, they'll be hitting each other. And that would be a disaster. That would be the last thing Renault needs, because obviously they're massively under pressure in that project.
Yeah, for sure. And imagine what the highest, the ones who are at the top in Renault, in the big company, thinks when Daniel Ricciardo comes to Renault, drives there for 2 years, gets big money, really big money, and then bails ship after 2 years to go to Ferrari and get even bigger money, or at least the same amount of money.
Having spent potentially half of this year crashing into his teammate or blocking his teammate or wasting each other's time, it's not a very good situation to be in. They need everybody to behave.
So what does Renault need to do to offer something sustainable for Daniel Ricciardo to make him stay? Because he seems to be the guy for the silly season for 21.
He's pretty much the only top-line driver who would be on the market and desirable to more than one team, because obviously Bottas's future and Hamilton's future aren't set. But Hamilton, obviously, we're pretty much expecting him to stay at Mercedes. And then Bottas, I don't think Bottas is really in command of his future, whereas Ricciardo is. And I think the first thing Renault need to do is prove that they've actually improved the car. And they've sort of passed that first test, because it looks a little bit like they're quite happy with the progress they've made with the 20 car. But then it will be actually put that into practice. So go to Australia, get straight into Q3, score points and be best of the rest. But then the big thing will be how the early developments go at the start of the season. They basically need to convince Ricciardo that they've definitely learned from last year and they're not going to make the same mistakes. Because as Cyril Abitbol said at the team's launch, if they can't prove that they can make a better car from 2019 to 2020, why should Ricciardo believe that they can make a better car for 2021 when the rules change? And that is going to be the key, because if they can't convince Ricciardo that they're going to make a better car, why would he stay there? I know he's earning a load of money. It's at least $20-25 million a year, which is an insane amount of money. But he's also a sportsman and a top-class racing driver. So yeah, it's a load of money, but he can probably command quite a nice salary somewhere else. And for the sake of driving around finishing 7th, 8th or 9th?
But what bugs me a bit, he left Red Bull where he had decent salary. Was it 12 million euros or whatever? Something like that. And he went for Renault, who offered him more. He left a race-winning car because he didn't have equality with Max Verstappen. And now we're talking about Ferrari and probably joining Charles Leclerc if Sebastian Vettel leaves. And then he's in the same situation again. He's going to drive with the driver who they have committed to strongly up until 2024, and he comes in and thinks he's going to be a world champion within that team. I mean, he's sort of ending up like, I don't know where he ends up, actually.
It is a slightly weird one. The big difference between Ferrari and Red Bull is I really don't think Ricciardo believed in Honda. I think that was, I reckon if he'd have had more confidence that that package would be better than it was when it was Red Bull Renault, I suspect he would have taken the lumps of being Verstappen's teammate and carried on. But I do think it was a combination of not being totally wowed by Red Bull and Honda and having a load of money offered him at Renault. But now he's gone to the other side and the grass isn't any greener. So now it's like, well, where do I go now? I still think there's no reason why he couldn't end up back at Red Bull. They still think quite highly of him, and they do like each other, and I think there is respect there. Whether or not he'd want to go up against Verstappen again, I'm not sure. But if, for example, because Verstappen's contract, the long-term one, that is going to have exit clauses in it. It's going to be dependent on the performance of the car or the engine or where they are in the championship. If Lewis Hamilton just decides, actually, I'm not going to continue, is there a way that Mercedes can get hold of Verstappen? And if not for this year, maybe for next year. So if Verstappen leaves, who do Red Bull get to be their number one driver? I don't see anyone that's there as a real option. Ricciardo's a known quantity, and because he's such a likeable guy, I think he is still held in high esteem there. But the change to Ferrari would be much more sensible. It seems much more likely, because although I still expect Vettel to stay on, he's the most likely of the big guys to disappear off the grid. And then that's just about making amends for the mistake that Ricciardo's made by going to Renault, because at least he then puts himself back into a team that in theory can fight for the title. So yeah, you're in someone else's team and you're maybe the de facto number two driver, but you're the de facto number two driver earning a lot of money driving for a team that might be able to win the world championship, which is a better trade than doing a deal with a Renault or maybe go to McLaren, because Ricciardo did have some talks with McLaren about maybe going there before he joined Renault. So he has a lot of options. It's just going to depend whether or not the financial elements versus the personal elements versus the competitive elements, like which of those wins out and which seat is available when he makes that decision. Because it could be that he holds out thinking, oh, just maybe Vettel will retire, and he waits, and then he misses, and then Vettel doesn't retire and he misses his chance to go somewhere else. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, very, very much so. Really interesting to see whatever happens in that perspective. Okay, thank you very much, Scott. You gave us a real good teaser of the Drive to Survive Season 2 coming on Friday, the 28th. The second episode, you say, is the one with the some fireworks in it.
I think it's the second episode.
Some smashed doors or whatever I've heard.
Yeah, exactly. So that should be interesting. I'm looking forward to it. That and the Mercedes German Grand Prix disaster, because they were in Netflix were in the Mercedes garage for that implosion. So that'll be good to watch as well.
Yeah, it's going to be good fun. Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to season two, because season one was good, but not what I expected from it. I wanted some more, but I guess you and I live in the environment every day. It's tough for them to sort of give us what we want, but the general audience have been very, very, very enthusiastic. I actually met a girl just a couple of days ago who is super hooked on Formula One now, after I've seen Drive to Survive and see every race she can get hold of. So it has done its thing.
Yeah, we're not the target audience after all, are we? They've gone for that more sort of casual fan, but something that also appeals to people who do watch it from afar. And by all accounts, I think they've struck quite a good note.
So you and I only want to be spotted now in the series.
I did spot myself in a couple of episodes in the first season, and I did. There was a bit of novelty of like, oh, look at that! I'm technically on Netflix, which
like
is quite
10
fun.
Seconds of fame.
Exactly,
that's good fun. Okay, you leave tomorrow morning for Barcelona, yes. And last 3 days of testing. I guess the teams doesn't need these four-day weeks that they had, these three-day weeks. I mean, they do like 150 laps a day. Do they even need as much as 3 days a week?
We could go to Melbourne now. Yeah. And everyone would have a pretty good idea of what to do, and there wouldn't be any nasty surprises. The key thing will be next year, obviously, all new cars. So let's see there'll be a few more breakdowns. But even last week, towards the end, as teams started to push things a bit harder, the red flags came out. So there is always an opportunity to learn something, and teams will always want more track time, but the reduction to 3 days a week, I don't see any difference in terms of how prepared the teams are going to be. So I think that has also been a success. But you never know, maybe we'll get there this week and a bunch of people will hit crisis and wish they had an extra day of running.
That's right. And you are also with the new team, the race.com. It's you, it's Ed Straw, it's Mark Hughes, and you have Gary Anders on by your
side. Yeah.
So it's a good coverage. Use that website if you really need in-depth stuff.
Yeah, and don't forget the hyphen. It's the-race.com. That's if you want to go to the URL. And then we do loads of coverage during the day itself on social media. So
you are really busy, I would say.
At We Are The Race on your social media platform of choice. End of day podcast, videos on YouTube. So however you want your F1 content, we're going to do our best to bring you. And obviously, you know, if opportunities like to come on this podcast and to write some stuff on online in Sweden as well. So there's lots of different ways that we're trying to give everyone what they want from F1.
Really good. Thank you so much, Scott. Have a nice trip down to Barcelona. I will stick to the TV back home, and we'll see each other in Melbourne.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.